This is Sam Roggeveen. I'm with Anthony Bourbolo, Research Director at the Lowy Institute, and on the line, Daniel Flitton with the Age newspaper in Melbourne. We're going to talk a little bit over the next 10 minutes or so about the Turnbull era, and in particular about the foreign and national security policy under the Turnbull Prime Ministership. Let's start with Malcolm Turnbull himself. Let me begin with a few thoughts of my own. I happened to write an article about this in January, when the first, I guess, aborted spill motion happened. At the time, I said that I thought that Turnbull was on the horns of a really terrible dilemma on the subject of climate change. His entire political personality was tied to that issue, and it was very difficult to see how he could take the leadership and not come back to his views on emissions trading. It seems at the moment as if Turnbull, as somebody pointed out online earlier today, Turnbull is prepared to allow all points of view on climate change within his party except his own on an emissions trading scheme. So it seems he has changed his mind on that issue. One thing that helps him in this regard is the fact that the international climate has changed so much. There's so much more momentum now in favour of serious abatement on emissions around the China-US agreement late last year. There seems to be some pretty serious momentum towards the Paris conference at the end of the year. So maybe that momentum on the global stage will give Turnbull the freedom eventually to act as I think his instincts suggest he really wants to. The other thing I wrote about back in January is that Turnbull is much more of a realist, particularly when it comes to the US relationship, as opposed to Abbott. And I think before him, both Labor prime ministers who were, I think, slightly more sentimental about the US relationship. Julia Gillard in particular, she gave that famous speech to the US Congress in which, you know, she reduced Congress to tears through her evocations of US potential. And Abbott gave a speech in Washington a few years ago in which he said that Australians didn't regard Americans as foreigners. Turnbull's far less sentimental than that. He treats great powers, he's said this publicly, you know, he treats great powers in a far less sentimental way and in a far more realist way. So I think he'll deal with the Americans on that level and not on the level of sort of personal affection in the relationship. So, Anthony and Dan, let me open it up to you guys to comment on any of that or anything else you'd like to about Turnbull's basic foreign policy philosophy. Dan, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think what we'll see first up is a change in style. I don't mean to be too flippant about it, but I don't imagine that Turnbull's going to embrace language of the shirt front, for instance, when he's confronted with an event like, or hopefully not, but like what happened with the shooting down of MH17. I do think that we'll see a fair bit of continuity across from Abbott to Turnbull in terms of policy settings. That said, I think it'll be where it'll become more important is how events transpire in the months and possibly years ahead, and how Turnbull reacts to these international events. There's such a role now for leaders in terms of diplomacy and summiteering and that sort of thing. So there'll be a heavy focus on Turnbull, allowing that Julie Bishop is obviously continuing in the job. But one thing is that unlike the changeover from Kevin Rudd to Julia Gillard, I can't think of any great pet project like Kevin Rudd had set in motion the UN Security Council bid, for instance, or he was talking in those days about the Asia Pacific community idea. There's no great project that Abbott has set in motion that Turnbull's going to be expected or judged on whether he's continuing it or not. So I think the chances of sort of subtle shifts over time are more likely than any big breaks.
And there'll be a shift in rhetoric as well, right? It's hard to imagine Turnbull talking about a death cult.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll be really interested to see how much engagement he takes in the conflict in the Middle East, or the conflicts in the Middle East, I should say, in the months ahead, because it was fairly widely judged that Tony Abbott's talking about actions on it was part of also gelled into a political campaign at home, a domestic political campaign. But I think Turnbull's, my guess at this stage would be that Turnbull's going to be much more focused on making sure that he gets elected again in 12 months, because we've talked about 5 years and five Australian prime ministers. It's a very real chance that we'd have six Australian prime ministers in 6 years next year if the coalition goes down at the election. So that's going to be his first focus. And when it comes to international issues, I think you're absolutely right on climate change questions. He's got a lot more room to move on that now because the world has moved on from 2009. I'm not sure that the push for abatement is stronger now than it was in the run-up to Copenhagen. Remember, there was a lot of enthusiasm back then, and that was part of it. But the issue around scepticism has been maybe not dealt with, but it's certainly been aired a lot more. So that whole discussion has changed.
Anthony?
Picking up a couple of things that both of you said. You know, as Dan alluded to, you know, foreign policy is partly about what you want to do, but it's mainly about what happens to you, particularly in a country of Australia's size and power. So, you know, I think that, you know, Dan's right. He, you know, as a PM, he hasn't got a pet project yet, but he may well develop one, as previous PMs have on foreign policy. I think, nevertheless, this is also going to, you know, Turnbull coming to power means that, this will be an increase in, Julie Bishop's role. And responsibility for foreign policy making, because I think at least initially, he will let her take a lot of the day-to-day running. I mean, her stature and her position in the government, I think it was very strong before, but I think it's grown even stronger now. And short of Turnbull getting an international policy advisor who has particularly strong views of their own on the direction the government should take on foreign policy, I think this will mean that Julie's role in setting the course on foreign policy will be particularly strong. In terms of the Middle East, I think, you know, in terms of terrorism in the Middle East, I think there will be a change in tone, and that's actually important and welcome. And it's something I think the national, you know, the agencies responsible for counterterrorism, have probably been calling for, that it's important that, you know, for reasons of, you know, effective CT policy at home, that the PM and the government reach out a bit more to the, Muslim community in Australia. So that will help. In terms of substance, I don't see that, Turnbull will suddenly make any big, changes, in terms of, you know, legislation. And there's about half of that CT legislation that still has to go through the parliament. There's nothing in it kind of politically or from a security perspective to kind of start, reinvestigating some of these legislative changes, given the risk that, you know, if you water them down or weaken them and a couple of weeks later, there's a terrorist attack in Australia, you're kind of really, really leaving yourself a hostage to fortune. And that goes also for the current deployments in the Middle East, where, you know, we play a marginal but nevertheless significant role in what is basically a containment operation of Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. I think, you know, the advice will be let's keep it going. It may be that Turnbull may be less inclined to keep it going for as long as an Abbott government was, but I don't think there'll be any instinct to change that dramatically, given that, you know, it is also very much a function of the relationship with the US, and he wanted to provide some reassurance there. The bigger question around Syria and Iraq is, in obviously the questions that have been raised about whether this US strategy, against Islamic State, such as it is working. And it's, you know, it's containing Islamic State, but it's not going to defeat it. And what role should we play there? But also, and this is going to be a more immediate problem, is it's fairly clear now that the Russians are sending in a significant military presence into Syria. this is going to complicate the situation on the ground and in the air immensely, just from the perspective of deconfliction of having a very, very busy airspace. And indeed, the airborne early warning control aircraft that Australia deploys is actually going to become more important probably than less important for that reason.
Okay, let's turn now to the new Turnbull cabinet, and in particular, one of the surprises from the cabinet, which was the appointment of Maurice Payne as defence minister. Maybe I'm revealing my own ignorance here, but I think a fairly unknown quantity. Anthony, can you give us any background about Maurice Payne's expertise on national security and foreign policy issues?
Look, I don't know her well, and I have to admit that there'd been talk of Chris Pyne getting the defence portfolio, and when I looked on the online yesterday afternoon, I initially thought there must have been a misprint that was, Payne instead of Pyne. Having said that, I actually think the more I think about it, I think it's actually a good decision. From what we know about her, she is smart, hardworking, has worked on development, but also foreign policy issues as a senator in the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, I think, in the past, and very diligent. I mean, it kind of goes to the flavour of the cabinet more generally, where Turnbull's basically, it's a kind of a, show me what you can do, cabinet. And that's going to succeed with some of them, and it's not going to succeed with others, and time will tell. The challenge for Payne is not going to be, the issue is not going to be her lack of ability or her lack of intelligence, but she's taking on probably the most complex portfolio, a portfolio that has consumed, over the years, some very smart politicians and some very smart bureaucrats. She really is facing a very significant challenge there. But nevertheless, I think, in terms of an injection of fresh blood, fresh thinking, fresh energy, it's a good move.
Daniel, do you want to add something on Maurice Payne?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know her well. I've spoken to her a couple of times, and that was many years ago when she did have a more active interest in international development issues. And I think it was actually through the Lowy Institute that I spoke to her. So I was, like, I think most, it was sort of a surprising appointment in one respect. I think it also surprised me, can I call it a dummy spit, how much Kevin Andrews made of his not being appointed. And just to address that point, I don't see any great problem with the changeover of defence ministers if this is an opportunity in putting Maurice Payne in that job. Having been a long-standing senator and still a big question mark over whether or not the coalition gets re-elected, but she may well be in the job for some years. So it may be that defence gets, assuming competency and assuming they get re-elected, it may well be that defence gets the continuity that they're looking for. But I think Anthony's spot on with that last comment that there's a chance here for some fresh thinking, and that's really an opportunity to reassess a lot of the assumptions around the defence portfolio. And in that sense, I don't say this with any great inside knowledge, but I'm not sure that the defence white paper, that we might expect to see that soon. I think that there's a chance that if she feels that she's going to be in the job for a while, she's really going to want to put her stamp on it. Mm. So as much as Kevin Andrews came out yesterday and said it's ready to go, I think it may be that that'll get revisited.
I think that the fact that Andrews came out and said it's ready to go is actually a hint that he knows that not just Payne, but also Turnbull will want to have a look at the defence white paper. So I think almost inevitably he's going to push it back.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. Finally, let's talk about Joe Hockey, who is resigning from the Parliament, and there's intense speculation now that he'll be appointed as the next Australian ambassador to Washington. Kim Beazley's extended appointment ends at the end of this year, I believe.
He's now been extended into next year.
Oh, is that right? Mm. Until...
Yeah, it depends on who you talk to.
Ah, right. Yeah. Okay. But, Dan, let me ask you this. Is this an appointment? Let's assume this goes ahead. Would this be an appointment that's made on the merits of hockey as an ambassador, or was it offered as a way to ease him out of the Treasury and the Parliament?
I don't get the sense that it was offered in that way. I honestly don't know. But look, let's just take what Joe Hockey said already on face value. He said that he wants to spend more time with the young family. Well, frankly, the Washington job's not going to be one that would allow him to do that. I seem to remember hearing, I think it was Dennis Richardson once said, after he'd been in the job, that he got invited or had to accept something like 430 dinner invitations in any given year. So that meant that he was at more than one dinner a night quite regularly. And it's the sort of thing that you have to do when you're in that job. So if Hockey genuinely wants to step back and spend more time with the family, that job's a very consuming one. So that's one thing that I'd just take some pause on before we sort of get too carried away with the speculation. It's good to have politicians in that job because politicians do speak the language of politicians to one another, and that's generally been the assumption that that's a good thing to have in Washington. But there was lots of speculation about the sort of people that might get that job under Tony Abbott, and one of them was Andrew Shearer, who was Mr. Abbott's foreign policy advisor. He's now going to take a break, as I understand it. I'm not sure whether Hockey gets that gig. I guess it's just a let's watch and see.
Anthony,
I think the indications I see is that he's going to get that gig. I think he was telling this morning that he said that when he was asked directly about it, he wasn't commenting. Of course, before he can, you know, before they can release it, they have to get Agramon from the US. He's a logical fit. They've been looking for someone for months. And this is why, you know, Beasley's been, he's already been extended, but, you know, my understanding was that he's been extended possibly even twice into next year because they were struggling to find someone. People were talking about Brendan Nelson, who apparently didn't want the job. Andrew Robb, who also didn't want the job.
Why is Hockey a logical fit though, given that the relationship is so security focused and Hockey's expertise lies in economics?
Logical from the perspective of, the very clear view that it should be a political figure rather than a bureaucrat. Two, because, you know, in that particular context, people that are kind of gregarious, big personalities, you know, in an American context do better, than, you know, people that are a bit more reserved, and in that sense, I think he will do a good job. The economic relationship with the United States is also very important. Yes, you can kind of raise the question about, well, what about, do you need someone that has a stronger kind of political strategic focus? But remember, the way it works with political appointees in these missions is that, it's not a kind of traditional ambassadorial appointment. There are lots of people in the mission that will handle those kind of responsibilities. You know, if it is Hockey, he'll have a very capable and experienced number two in Caroline Miller.
And look, I mean, the other thing too is he would have sat on NSC during the Abbott years, so it's not as if he's completely devoid of knowledge about the security thing, just in the same way that the treasurers have previously, and that Scott Morrison's going to now. I mean, the other thing I guess with Hockey that runs, I'll just add this as another question mark. There's been a lot of political appointments under the coalition under Tony Abbott. I'm pretty sure that it's at the highest rate that it's ever been for the Australian diplomatic service. So that might be something else just to consider. I don't know that would stop the appointment, but Mr. Abbott pushed a lot of political appointments out into diplomatic jobs. And for instance, the former Australian Federal Police Chief ended up in Ottawa. So there's a question around the sort of career diplomatic service that we have and whether that's something we want to maintain. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a bit of pressure coming from DFAT too to make sure, and Washington might not be the post, but to make sure that these political appointments don't become too much of a habit, because what will happen is that when government eventually turns over, whether it's at this election or the next one or whenever, the other side will get in and they'll want to put all their own people in. So you'll end up with a kind of closer to the US approximation of a more of an approximation of the US system.
I think it's a really important point, but I think definitely there'll be a push against it. But I think the US posting's a bit quarantined from it, from that kind of argument, because it has so typically been, well, often been a political appointee. But I completely agree with you that, I think they'll, you know, DFAT will certainly be pushing, the PM, the PMO and the government away from, you know, the practice of appointing even more ambassadors from political ranks.
Anthony Bulbelow, Dan Flinton, thanks for your time.
Pleasure.
No worries, mate.